يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. Now, in my introduction to Middle East Analysis, on almost every occasion, I have to lament the fact that several incredibly high-profile incidents have occurred in the Middle East, North Africa region, and today is no different. We have Palestine to talk about. It is now recognised by the UN General Assembly as a non-member observer state. The Egyptian constitution and the manner in which it has come about, that's another key issue, and fears of chemical weapons in Syria. Syria never off the map at the minute and never off the agenda. To talk about all these things and what they mean to the region, the wider region and the rest of the world, is Dr. Harry Hagopian, our consultant on the Middle East, North Africa region. Harry, how are you?
I'm fine, James. Nice to be here again. And a wonderful intro, actually, because you're absolutely right. Every time we come here, there's always new things to talk about. There are always new developments, a lot of them scary, some of them joyful. We are in the Advent season, so we have a sense of anticipation as well. And it would be interesting to sort of pause for just a couple of minutes on those three themes that you identified just now.
Now, equally, we're not a news agency, so I couldn't really wheel you into the studio at the tail end of last week to talk about some of these major, major events.
True.
But let's try and tackle them anyway now. Bring us up to date with the situation. Let's start with Israel-Palestine, and in particular Palestine, and its new status, Harry.
Well, it's interesting because now Palestine, you said in your intro that it has become a non-member observer state, pretty much like the Vatican, the United Nations, and in a sense now it is a real state. So the Palestinians can call themselves the state of Palestine. The only difference between that and a real state is that this is a virtual state on paper. It's a legal state, it's a virtual state, but it's not still a practical state because most of Palestine is under occupation, according to international law. And in that sense, it is a big achievement for the Palestinians, I think. It is also an achievement, I hope, for the two-state solution. But it still does not deliver a state, as we understand it, sovereign with rights and responsibilities.
And that's what I was going to ask. I was going to ask, what does this mean in terms of its position in the international community?
Well, what it means in terms of the international community from where it was pre the vote, which was overwhelmingly in favor of this Palestinian bid, is that not only has Palestine formally become a state, but that also it could apply to the 15 or so international organizations now as a state. For instance, the World Health Organization, the Food Agency, FAO, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice. So in a sense, it has got the trimmings of a state, but it is still not a state. So Palestinians would wake up every morning pretty much feeling in the same situation they have been for over 60 years. Nothing has changed there. Only something has changed on paper, as well as the hope that something practical will come out of this, that it would encourage the two parties, Israelis and Palestinians, to go once again into negotiations rather than make the situation even more difficult and more fraught with danger.
Now, I would worry about opening a can of worms by mentioning Israel's reaction to this, but it's probably not really too unexpected, is it?
No, it's not unexpected in the sense that they had already made it quite clear, the Israeli government, that they are going to oppose quite vociferously this bid by President of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Palestinians. The Israeli ambassador, Ron Prosor, at the United Nations was quite clear in his non-acceptance of this bid. However, interestingly enough, over 190 countries voted in favor of the bid, and only nine voted against it. Of those nine, the only European country was the Czech Republic. So in a sense, it was quite an interesting outcome. However, there is also a bit of division, I feel, James, within Israel about the outcome. Not everybody is against this bid, because a lot of people think that it is actually conducive to negotiations resuming for a two-state solution, because we are coming to a situation where we either have to go for a two-state solution, or that this whole vision that we have all upheld for a long while about Israel and Palestine, two sovereign states with all their contiguous rights, with all their security, living peacefully next to each other, will become a non-reality, even more than it is a non-reality now, when one state, Israel, is very much a physical reality and the other one is pretty much only a reality on paper. However, unfortunately, I believe that the Israeli government at the moment, which is in power, led by Prime Minister Netanyahu and Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, have actually undertaken some punitive steps almost against the Palestinians. For instance, they have enhanced or promised to enhance the settlements and the building of housing units in particularly sensitive parts of occupied territory, such as the E1 development area, which every single American president, from George W. Bush to Clinton to Obama, have opposed. Because, James, what would happen if there are housing units built in the E1 development area? Then that would cut off Ramallah and Bethlehem in the West Bank from Jerusalem, and that would pretty much make the two-state solution redundant. Danny Seidman, some of our listeners might know him. He's an Israeli lawyer from Jerusalem. He actually said that the E1, he described it as the fatal heart attack for the two-state solution. And he even went further dramatically and said that Prime Minister Netanyahu was wielding the doomsday weapon. So in a sense, this increase in settlements is not the response really to what the Palestinians are aspiring for, which is their self-determination. Another measure that the Israeli authorities have taken is to withhold the tax revenues from the Palestinian, roughly some 100 million, which they collect on behalf of the Palestinians, according to the Paris Protocol Agreement. And that also enhances, increases the financial difficulty of the Palestinians. So instead of actually saying, okay, we have a bid, we have a vote, we have a state on paper, Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister of Israel, said that this was a good thing. And there are other people in Israel who think that this bid is fine because it strengthens the hand of the Palestinian Authority to negotiate with Israel, and maybe we could reach to some sort of a peace solution. Whereas those punitive actions make that impossible and would really make me question whether the current government does really want a two-state solution or not. If it does, why is it doing everything to make that impossible? And if it doesn't want a two-state solution, does it also mean that it doesn't want peace?
If I was to cut to the chase and we look at peace at the top of a 100-rung ladder, and I ask you the question, well, is this actually putting a foot on that ladder to at least head upwards and stop the rockets on the one hand and stop the bombs from planes on the other? Is it the first rung?
Well, I hope so. I hope it's the first rung, and I hope it's more than the first rung, because inevitably, it has to start somewhere. Negotiations had been frozen, settlements had been increasing, they had been encroaching upon Palestinian territory, making life very difficult for the Palestinians, making the viability of a two-state solution even more remote than it was, say, 2 years ago. And now that the Palestinians have got this move that has been supported by well over two-thirds of the World Committee, that what they need to do is go back into negotiations earnestly, honestly, in order to strike a deal and create this two-state solution everybody's talking about. And in order to do that, nobody can deny, and I will be the first person not to deny, that the real power behind this would have to be the United States. If the United States actually acts as an honest broker, if it really pushes the negotiations forward, then we might get something. If it doesn't, then I think we are going to go in into another wishy-washy episode, more settlements, more mistrust between the parties, and one day we're going to wake up and we're going to realize, as Danny Seidman said, I just quoted him now, that there has been a heart attack, the two-state solution is redundant, the Palestinians will not be able to get their viable sovereign state next to Israel, and you know what? That is not going to be the end of the story. That is going to be the beginning of more violence, the beginning of more animosity, and the beginning of more bloodletting and deaths, something nobody, Palestinian or Israeli, or anybody else, should wish for.
Moving on, is it likely that there'll be a few heart attacks in Egypt at both the speed and the manner at which the new Egyptian constitution has been brought in? Because there was some Christian opposition, I read.
There was not only some Christian opposition. I think in Egypt what has happened is that President Morsi is basically behaving between as a president of the whole of Egypt on the one hand and as a leader within the Muslim Brotherhood on the other. If you look at Egypt now, most of the Islamist movements, the Salafist and Muslim Brotherhood movements, support this draft constitution, which is being put to a referendum on the 15th of December. A lot of other forces also support it. However, there is another part of the country, roughly speaking, and this is not accurate, James, so don't ask me to give you percentages. Another half of the country is against it. People like Al-Baradei, people like Sabahi, people like Badawi, people like Amr Musa, who are against it because they suggest that this is basically the usurping of power by the president at the expense of the country. And what I would say, and I've said this before again, is that a president should look at the whole country, and the whole country is all its components coming together. And a constitution is not a political manifesto of one party. It is basically the tool, the motor, the engine upon which a country runs. That is what in international law a constitution is looked upon. And therefore, that constitution should represent the rights and responsibilities of all Egyptians, irrespective of their ideologies and political backgrounds. That is what we're not seeing at the moment, because there are two very different, diametrically opposed political schools of thought in Egypt, and therefore the clashes we're seeing is, no matter what one side does, is perceived by the other as a usurpation of power. So in that sense, we are in a difficult situation, but we need to move forward because Egypt is hugely important for the whole Middle East, North Africa, and the world.
Now, Morsi was very instrumental in the Hudna that brought a peace agreement between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Is he in danger of kind of tainting that sort of Middle East fixer role, self-imposed to a certain extent, by causing a little too much trouble in his own country?
I think it is, because he was riding very, very high on the crest of that wave when he managed to get Hamas and Israel to agree on this very short text which defined the truce, or the Hudna we spoke about in an earlier podcast. Now, in that sense, yes, he was very important, very vital. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, President Obama, everybody else said, wonderful, Egypt is reassuming its regional role within the Middle East and North Africa. And look what happened. The next day, perhaps because he thought he is now powerful, he decided to push forward the agenda of the draft constitution. What he basically did, he said, I want that constituent assembly to come up with the draft constitution. I'll put it to a public referendum, and if it is approved, then that's it. This is the new constitution. But interestingly enough, as I was just saying, the country did not agree fully with him. And more worrying about that is that the judges, not all of them, let me very clearly underline, but a lot of the judges, particularly those from the higher constitutional court and others, disagree with him. They're so much in disagreement with him that they refuse to supervise legally the referendum that is meant to take place on the 15th of December. So in a sense, what is happening, James? The bottom line is that there is a mix-up in the three arms of the state, the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. And it seems to me nobody knows who has the right to run and be responsible for all those three arms. The executive, in my opinion, is the president. The legislative should be a free parliament, and the judiciary should be basically the judges. But there is an enmeshing, an overlapping of those three arms, which is causing also some of the fears. Put on it the secular agenda of one part of Egypt with the Islamist agenda of another part, and you get a very interesting jigsaw where the pieces do not very comfortably fit together to give us the larger picture.
But watching someone try and put those pieces together with an agenda is quite interesting, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
Let's move on now to Syria. Now, perhaps for 2 years almost, we've been talking about potential exit strategies for al-Assad's regime. And we've always had that nagging fear. The media's had that nagging fear. Everyone's had that nagging fear of chemical weapons. What's going on out there?
James, I'm very worried about that. I still do not agree, do not believe, cannot think that anybody, any president, any responsible citizen in authority in any country would unleash chemical weapons against his people. So in a sense, although there are reports of movements of those chemical weapons in some parts of Syria, some of those weapons could be found along the Jordanian border as well. I still somehow think it is so preposterous, so outrageous that a president or his coterie of rulers would actually unleash chemical weapons against people that are fighting with AK-47s against T-55 tanks and MiG-23 airplanes. I somehow do not think that is doable. And if it is, then really, God help us all, not only the Syrians, but the whole region. And that, in my opinion, would really eventually force the hand of the West, particularly the United States, which has been so reluctant to move in, to become more involved with the Syrian crisis, would have no other option but to move in, because it becomes extremely critical, not only for Syria, but for the whole region. However, as I follow the digital news, as I follow the tweets coming around, as I follow now, let me impress you, NewsFoo, for instance, digitally, I get all the news about the sense of violence, the bloodshedding, the bloodletting that is taking place in Syria, so much so that at the moment I'm a little bit worried whether Assad is there or Assad is not there, who is there now, who comes next. The country is in such an unsettled state of flux that I really worry about what is going to happen next. So it's very uncertain in a sense, and I hope that not only chemical weapons will not be used, but that I come back to the essential point I've made before. Irrespective of whether we love Bashar al-Assad or we hate Bashar al-Assad, because there are many people who hate him and can't stand the sight of him, but there are still some factions and some people in Syria who support him. So whether we do one or the other, if it is in the interest of Syria and the long-term peace and prosperity and unity of Syria, not its fragmentation, that he goes, please let him take his Samsonite bag and go somewhere else. I think he can live very comfortably elsewhere and spare the country further bloodletting and further violence.
Well, well put. And I think at a time where we're praying for Syria, amongst all the other people of the Middle East, that's well worth bearing in mind. Well, Dr. Harry Hagopian, thanks for the whistle-stop tour and in-depth analysis, actually. You can keep up with Harry using the digital media, and particularly that medium of Twitter. I know a lot of you are part of the Twitterati, so get on there and check out Harry on @HarryHagopian. And please do take a look at our tweets as well. That's @CatholicEW. We're hosted as normal on catholicnews.org.uk, and I believe you're maybe off to the region next week, Harry, but I'm hoping I might be able to grab some of your time through Advent at some point so we can give our listeners an update before Christmas, but that remains a little to be seen.
Let's try and see how it goes.
For now, Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you very much.
Pleasure.